Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Public Goods Podcast. Today, I am very excited. As an ecosystem practitioner, as a public goods founder, I'm super excited to be welcoming Devansh to the pod. He has experience not only founding his own public goods funding platform around the journalism sector and tracking impact, but a lot of insight on working with different L2s, especially with Arbitrum DAO, which is a whole set and myriad of case studies people can learn from. And so, yeah, without further ado, welcome Devansh to the pod.
Yeah, thanks for getting me on and really happy to share whatever I've learned, both in trying to expand Web3 new use cases to journalists and media funders and evaluators, and also about how we can do ecosystem growth more smartly. I think both of those are things that I can shed some light on.
Yeah, and I would love to learn more about you in this space. You seem someone who's very mission aligned, very focused on your quest and what you want to do in the world. And usually there's some type of green pill story arc that goes on in this. So, like, when did you first maybe not even get into Web3, but get into regeneration and green pilling, maybe outside the context of Web3?
Yeah, so it actually started when I was in undergrad and college, where I did philosophy in my undergrad. So that usually left me a lot of free time as well to go and pursue my own interests. So I started a magazine in college, and as part of that magazine, we ran an interview with my principal. And in that, he said a bunch of stupid things, which we published because we had him on camera, and he didn't like that at all. And he fanned our magazine. He said that it was a breach of faith. You should have sent it to me for editing before publishing, which is something you never do in journalism, especially if you have them on camera. So after that happened, then he banned the magazine. So I decided to take my principal to court because I said it's not right that he's banning a magazine that we started with our own effort and he's not even done anything to contribute to its growth. And that became like a national news story. So even today, if you type Devansh Mehta, Stephen's Weekly, you'll see like a bunch of news articles that pop up and videos with news channels. So that's really where I started this full missionary bent that we should ensure free speech and that we can speak truth to power. And after that, I basically joined the Columbia Journalism School where I got to learn how to mess around with systems rather than individuals. So I got to work on something related to the Panama Papers investigations, all of the journalists who were involved in that. I broke a pretty groundbreaking story about how an Azerbaijan dictator had an airlines which had got contracts from the Pentagon, from the US Pentagon, loan guarantees, and it created huge impact after its publication. But something I realized was that all of these stories didn't have business models behind them. It was always journalists going and writing grants and asking for more money. So that's where I really stumbled into Web3. As a funding model for the journalism that matters and that actually creates quantifiable and verifiable impact. And I'll stop over here, but something I found is that actually Web3 is much more aligned with the ideals of censorship resistance and speaking truth to power than many investigative journalists and newsrooms today. So I've definitely found a very welcoming home in the Web3 space over the last 3 years that I've been in the space now.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. I feel like a lot of us get into Web3 maybe because we heard about maybe speculative or even the dark web or this maybe kind of anarchist mentality, or someone is in Web3 and they're a friend and they onboarded us. It's very little that people actually are in the industry that they're in and then use like that as their entry point. And so I think that's a beautiful transition and very in line with what you're doing. Could you kind of, while we're on the topic of the Web2 side of journalism, could you mentioned people getting grants. I think this is an unfamiliar concept for journalism where they have, traditional corporations and journalists who are hired there. Can you kind of break down how investigative journalism differs from regular journalism?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the distinction I draw is between situational awareness journalism, which tries to create a common operating picture for society. So like what's happening in Ukraine, what's going on in the DeFi space in crypto, all of that is situational awareness journalism. But the journalism that I'm more interested in and which I've worked on more is what I call actionable journalism, where you seek to get the right information to the right person at the right time. So something like the Panama Papers, it didn't get a lot of eyeballs, but it got the right information about tax evaders to the right people, which is government authorities and lawyers and activists. And it got it at the right time so they could file court cases and actually recover some of that money. Like the Panama Papers has brought back over $10 billion to true taxpayers and citizens. How much of that value is actually captured by journalists who did the story? Like very, very little. So I think that's also the way I define public goods in general, which is the difference between value creation and value capture. So we see this most egregiously in the case of investigative reporting, where they generate a lot of value, but the amount of value that they capture is like very, very low. It's all based on grants that they can raise and marketing that they do of their impact. So I think that's the common thread I see in the Web3 space and even in the Web2 journalism space, that how do we bridge the gap between those who are creating value and those who are actually capturing the value?
Yeah, and that actual definition is what we use at Potluck for our registration guidelines. Like your definition there, I think it's that value capture over creation is a beautiful definition that often, you know, people debate whether a VC qualifies, where it doesn't really necessarily matter as long as more value creation is made. There are a couple threads that I do want to expand upon. You mentioned, firstly, I think understanding, like, you mentioned impact, and that goes to like, okay, you said they did $10 billion in value. I know you're measuring impact. Like, how do they traditionally quantify this?
So I'll tell you the most cutting edge research on quantifying impact. So the most cutting edge is, which we found, is an organization in New York called Robin Hood Foundation, which quantifies every single grant that they fund. So they make their granting decisions entirely quantitative based on what they call benefit cost ratio. So something to remember is that impact is always relative to cost. If you educate one child, that's great. Is it good impact? Yes, if it's done at a reasonable cost. But if you spend $1 million to educate one child, I don't call that impact. I call that negative impact. So we always have to remember that impact is relative to cost. And the way that we are doing it is that you quantify the benefit. So for example, if this story got a court case filed, like for example, Ian Allison's story in CoinDesk, it broke the FTX house of cards, you know, it caused it to collapse. So if you had to quantify that story, we would quantify the value of the court case which was filed and how much assets eventually get returned to people. We would then calculate something called the counterfactual, and this is where things get tricky, which is that even if CoinDesk didn't exist and didn't do the story, there's still a chance that FTX would have still been exposed, right? We can't say that this probability is zero, that without CoinDesk, the impact wouldn't have happened. It might have happened, but it might have been delayed. So once you get the benefit, you have to do a thought experiment that even if the organization didn't exist, what is the chance that the impact would anyways have happened? Subtract both of these to get the true benefit, and then you divide that by the cost of actually doing the story. And that gives you something called a benefit cost ratio, where you can make claims like for every $1 we gave the organization, it generated $5 of benefit to society or $10 of benefit to society. And that actually allows you to standardize impact across various domains, whether that's health, whether that's journalism, whether that's benefiting your ecosystem. So we are, so right now we are in the early stages of trying to quantify different impact from citizen journalism outlets. Things like, I'll give you some examples which we are launching with. One of them is women weren't allowed to pray at a temple for 400 years. A media outlet reported on this and then they were allowed to pray after that at the temple because of the journalist reporting on it. Another example is there were people in a rural village who had killed five women because they were a witch. A small child had died, so they wanted to blame someone for that. And they said, these five women are witches and kill them. And they were just roaming around the village because even the police believed in that superstition. So then the media outlet reported on this and it caused outrage. And it actually led to the arrest of these, like, of the people who were behind the murder of these five witches. So these are some of the, like, these are some of the impacts that we are quantifying and trying to sell to consumers. The whole idea being that currently when we fund impact, it's entirely on the basis of brand. That, yeah, I've heard of New York Times, I've heard of ProPublica, I've heard of these big organizations, I can give them my money, or Red Cross. Whereas, like, you know, we want startups in the impact space to be able to compete on a level playing field. And that's what I really think impact certificates can do. Because here, as long as I like the impact that women were now allowed to pray at a temple, that these witch killers were brought to justice. So I just fund the impact directly without even researching too much into the organization that created the impact. So I think impact certificates can really change the way we fund impact by actually focusing on the work that was done rather than who did the work and the brand of the person who did that work.
Yeah, there's a couple of threads. We're kind of going into VoiceDeck as a platform. But before we go into the amazing work that you're doing there, I wanted to also, like, you know, also paint the status quo a little bit better, because certain things, like we just kind of learned that, like, you know, grants are given for investigative journalism. And so is that the standard for everywhere? What if a big corporation gives funding for something? How is that automated in terms of the actual cost associated with it? And then after the fact, like, it maybe the impact or the benefit is 1 to 2 years later. What is the time frame for gauging that impact, and then having the people who reported it or having the affected parties in the normal Web 2 case quantify that? Like, can you kind of talk about this journalism stack in that sense?
Right. So, I mean, there's almost no one who is quantifying journalism impact. A lot of it is on outputs. So, like, you know, if you had to publish 15 stories in Latin America, did you actually publish those 15 stories? Tick box, yes. Okay, I can fund you for the next tranche of the grant. So a lot of it is what they call milestone based, but it basically is outputs, that are you fulfilling the outputs that you committed to doing with the money that we give you. So that's currently how most, and like, if we take a step back and look at what actually funds in-depth journalism, it's basically either grants. If you look at nonprofit newsrooms like ICIJ, which is the International Center for Investigative Journalists, ProPublica, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, Bellingcat, these are all based on donations and grants. And the other model is what I call brand building. So people like New York Times have an investigative outlet, like, within their organization, because it builds their brand. And that drives subscriptions and ads and other things. So you have brand building or grants or donations as the only models which currently fund investigative reporting and in-depth journalism. That's the current status of how things are in the Web2 world in that sector.
And for brand building, it's like that is.
You're on mute. I couldn't catch you.
Yeah, I was saying, for the brand building part, is that kind of cost reported, or is that something that you have to go to each corporation? There's a set of corporations that, you know, do brand building that you know of, and then you have to kind of follow up.
Right. So every major newsroom does have an investigative arm. So, like, Boston Globe, which the movie Spotlight was based on. I don't know how many of your listeners have heard of Spotlight, but it's a great movie on an investigation done by the Boston Globe. So they have a small team of 3 to 4 reporters who just focus on investigative work. Same with New York Times, same with LA Times, same with all of the major media outlets. So it's a very small team usually, because it costs a lot of money. When you're writing one story every 6 months, there's no way that you can ever break even just on an eyeballs basis or on an advertising basis. So that's where we really require a new model, which actually makes it sustainable for a journalist to spend 6 months digging up a particular story and actually writing it out. And that currently doesn't exist in the world.
Interesting. So right now, how are you pulling the actual benefit right now, given that people aren't widely adopting VoiceDeck, and where are you pulling up for this to see that, you know, this person has shut down or opened up this church, or this violence has stopped, or there was yada yada and said impact? Where can that be kind of scraped? And
yeah, so I think the biggest source for actually scraping that is annual reports, especially when it comes to nonprofit news organizations. That's the biggest source that we found. Just going through all of their earlier annual reports, you get their total number of investigations published and also their budget. So you can also figure out the cost per investigation. And they also feature their most prominent impacts and what they did in the year, because the annual report is for donors. So donors have to be convinced of the impact. So that's usually where I've been scraping most of the impact. And also just reaching out to organizations directly. Like, some of them maintain a rigorous database of impact. So for every impact which comes from their story, they add it to a database that they already have. But this is like a private database, which they just keep on their server. So I think there's a real opportunity for taking that private database of impact onto a public blockchain and figuring out like a full new monetization model for impact is equal to profit for these newsrooms that have a pre-existing database of impact.
Awesome. And yeah, before we go into like the new stack, the Web3 stack, and how you're solving these challenges, I want to know a little bit more about the journalism stack. You know, are journalism using PGP keys? Are they like investigative journalists particularly? Like, what would you say the people on the fringe and maybe who are avoiding governments and people who are kind of maybe retaliating against them, like what in terms of tech are they already acclimated to?
Right. So I'll tell you a very funny story that Edward Snowden, while he was working in the government, he identified Glenn Greenwald as the person who he wanted to share the story with and the revelations with. But Glenn Greenwald didn't have PGP key encryption on his email. So he tried getting the message through various channels to Glenn Greenwald, but it just wasn't getting through. Finally, Edward Snowden had to take some risk in actually like directly emailing him from an anonymous email ID saying, please get PGP key. And even then Glenn Greenwald didn't do it. And finally, through Laura Poitras, he managed to get the message to Glenn Greenwald for getting PGP key and did it. And then the revelations broke and like the world got changed. So most journalists have a PGP key already, like they have it publicly on their Twitter and other things. But now, like recently, it's been moving towards Signal. Signal is where most of the investigative reporters are talking to their sources and getting information and documents and whatnot. But yeah, PGP key encryption and Signal is the main sources that is the main channels that investigative reporters are using today.
Okay, in terms of like somewhat more on like the WikiLeaks side, is there like a certain stack that they're implementing? Are they using Tor? Or if they have a major file upload, like what are the practices for like the people who really fear their life or fear retaliation outside of just communication with, you know, the people, communication with like maybe people who are witnesses or on the scene? Like, what are they actually, are there dead man switches? Like, what's like the kind of the spy end of the side or the really out there?
Yeah, so I mean, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, which did the full Panama Papers for Eurasia and Russia and that part of the world, they had something called Iron Box. I might be getting the name wrong, but they have like a secure uploading on their website. So anyone can leak documents to them on their website in a secure fashion. And they actually told me that they have way more documents leaked to them than they have reporters who can actually go through all of the leaks. So there's like a huge manpower crunch because, again, there's no business model. It's all based on grants and other things. So because of that, they actually can't look into a lot of the leaks that they are being given and that are uploaded on their secure channel.
All right, so we established the tech stack and how impact, I mean, a lot of industries we're already in, like they don't have that impact already there. So it's beautiful to see that that's there, and a lack of incentive models. And so VoiceDeck, like, can you kind of give an overview about what VoiceDeck is and a little bit about the user journeys for the journalists and the verifiers and things like that?
Right. So the founder of OCCRP, Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, posted on Twitter a very intriguing tweet, which is that we've totally returned our investigations, have returned over $10 billion to the public. And if we could capture even 1% of the amount of money that we've returned, our fundraising woes would disappear forever. You know, and investigative reporting would have all the money that we need. So that's what actually sent me down the rabbit hole of Web3. Like, they had a statistic that for every $1 donated to us, we have got $56 seized and $560 seized and returned to the public and other things. So that's where I thought that, hey, what if we could create something like a token which can serve as a accounting unit that, okay, for every story, these many assets were seized, and you can use that to kind of bootstrap a new funding model for investigative reporting with very quantifiable impact. And so this is the thought experiment that started us. And since then, like, something we've got as feedback is to really lean into the qualitative nature of journalism. So if you purely quantify it, that, yeah, the benefit is 50, so you create 50 of these imaginary tokens, it's like becoming too quantitative. And it's not leaning into what makes journalism special, which is every story is unique. So that's where we began to then integrate with the HyperCerts marketplace. So for those people who aren't familiar, HyperCerts are a standard of for impact certificates. The whole idea of an impact certificate is that, similar to how I might go to a market and buy a t-shirt, there's no way for me to go to a market and buy impact. I have to donate to an organization, and then 6 months later, the money is spent, and I might hear about how it was spent and what impact was created, but in all likelihood, I'm never going to hear about the impact that my money went towards. So the thought experiment, which the Effective Altruism community came up with in 2014, was that, what if we had, every time you create impact, you can mint an impact certificate, and then someone buys that certificate, and that gives you money for your next story. And I think, like, a lot of people ask me, like why VoiceDeck needs blockchain in the first place. And the answer I give them is that it's to ensure that every impact certificate is only sold one time. Like, we don't want a system where you create impact and then you sell that five different times, which is what the current Web2 world is, that, or even the Web3 world for that matter, that you create impact and then you market that impact to as many people as you can, each of whom gives you money. So ideally, like, blockchains, we know blockchains are good at solving the trouble spending problem. How can we also use it to solve the trouble selling of impact? That you register an impact certificate on chain, someone buys that impact certificate, and you have money for your next story. So currently, that's what we are working on. We are one of the first dApps to launch with the HyperCerts marketplace. We are on testnet currently with journalism impacts from citizen journalism outlets, and hoping for a mainnet launch this summer where you can actually buy these different impact certificates to show your support for that particular impact and that story, irrespective of the organization that produced it.
Okay, that's really excited for what's dropping on the summer. I'll link everything on the show notes, even the GitHub. It's all open source as well. But just, like, being clear, for we jump straight into the impact certificate. And so, from, I'm a journalist, like, I have a story. Do I come with the story first and then I update the impact, or do I give the cost I already got for the story? Is this a grants management platform where the actual, you know, money for investigative journalism is put up? Or like how is the flow different from the traditional, I get a grant and then afterward I report it in an annual report? Like what is the difference in the flow?
So the main difference is that this is entirely retro funding. So you've already created impact with your story, and then you upload that impact on VoiceDeck. We have evaluators like myself who quantify that impact, and then it becomes available for sale to the general public. And what's unique is that we actually put a price to that impact, and once it's raised enough money, like, it becomes locked. No one else can give money to that. So again, like, just to draw a contrast to the traditional Web2 world, there's no price to impact. You know, as much money as you can donate, the organization is happy to receive that. Whereas with us, like, you can only raise as much money as impact that you've created. So that's one of the other unique models, that it's good to have a price on things and not raise more money than you should.
Okay. And so coming as a journalist, like, is it, say I just want to put my story up, it hasn't made much impact, but then later down the line, there's a butterfly effect of more additional impact. Is there like a global story registry, and then you can add additional impacts associated with that story? Or how does that work? Is it a progressive yep. type of thing, or you do it when the impact has been made?
Yeah, so right now in version one, we only do it when the impact has been made. And that works because our main market is established media outlets. So these are media outlets which have already been operating for 5, 10, 15 years. So they already have the impact from their earlier stories. So we say that, hey, just like share with us your earlier stories, which already created impact, and we'll help you fundraise based on that. And then you can use that money for your next story, which would again create impact and start off this virtuous cycle. So VoiceDeck is not for people who don't already have an established database of impact from their reporting. It's more for people who have already spent a couple of years, have already got some impacts under their belt, and to start the virtuous cycle for them. In the future, we might want that to change and to create like prediction markets and betting markets, like, will this story create impact? But in a very bare bones V1, it's meant more for newsrooms who already have a private database of impact. We give them an incentive to take this private database on chain and to let people then support that and fund it in a variety of ways.
Okay, so we mentioned three stakeholders, the journalist, and then, you know, like the newsrooms who, or maybe even paying for the impact, or the general markets per se, you know, the buyers of these impact credits. And then you have the evaluators. On the evaluator side, you mentioned you being one of them. What is the incentive for the evaluators, and how does that scale?
Yeah, so the incentive for evaluators is that they get 5% of the money raised from the sale of an impact report. And a very like fundamental insight we had, breakthrough we had, was that you shouldn't try making benefit-cost ratios a single source of truth. That this story's resulted in a benefit cost of like 15. And that's like, you know, the ground truth, and you better believe that. That's the wrong approach to take. What we ideally want is multiple evaluators, each of whom calculate the benefit cost ratio. And then we take the mean or the median value of all of their different computations of impact. And as more and more evaluators join, the rewards to each evaluator reduces, because if there's only 5 evaluators, they each get 1% of that impact report sale. But once you have 50, then it gets again divided amongst 50 evaluators. So that's kind of how we plan to bootstrap the network of evaluators for quantifying the impact of journalism stories.
And are there any kind of incentive models or ways to prevent from the over-evaluation of impact to result into like higher commissions or payouts for the evaluators?
I mean, higher than the 5% from the sale of an impact report?
Well, the way I look at it is, like, if I'm getting 5% of anything, I want that to be from a bigger pie. And so, like, is there anything to like disincentivize, oh, this is making a lot of impact? Because I see that a lot in the grant space and in general. People will say they made a bigger impact than they did to unlock a certain tranche or anything like that. That's a big kind of problem, especially when you give people kickbacks. So I want to know if there was like, I know it's like V1, but if there's kind of thoughts into how to prevent that.
Yeah, the main way is that we're just restricting our evaluator pool. So it's only people who we know and who we trust and who are impartial. And that's the way we are doing it currently. In the future, we might want some form of self-evaluation by the media outlets, but evaluators still verify it and like kind of make sure that there's not too much exaggeration going on. But I think like the difference I draw is between omission and commission. So someone who's like a scammer, they can create a GoFundMe or a profile on like, you know, different channels, and they can just omit to mention that they haven't created any impact. Whereas with us, you would actually have to be dishonest and say that you created some impact which wasn't created, or exaggerate the impact which you have. And all of this is on chain. So if other people catch you exaggerating your impact or fictionalizing impact that you've created, that does affect your reputation because it's permanently stored on chain. So that actually reduces the kind of scope for grifters and other exaggerators to come on our platform, because they will be caught in their lie, and then that affects them long term.
One problem that we have, especially when disrupting or even revolutionizing a particular sector, is kind of the go-to-market strategy. I feel like a lot of times the people who have the money are the people who don't want their current business models to be disrupted. So in terms of like your go-to-market strategy of actually, you know, marketing and selling these impact certificates, I mean, it's very new in the Hypersearch space. Like they probably just launched in Denver. I don't know if they really like launched yet, but like the whole idea of, I mean, Hypersearch, people are minting it for a whole bunch of different use cases right now, but there is a perceived, you know, retro market that's about to happen, but no one's actually established that. So how are you looking to kind of go to market with these impact certs, and then who are you really looking to target, and what those conversations are looking like?
Yeah, so I'll say three things here. One is that Hypersearch's marketplace hasn't launched. We are the first ones to launch with the Hypersearch marketplace, which is much more permissioned. Right now, anyone can create a Hypersearch and try to increase its value, whereas the marketplace will be much more curated and much more specialized and have evaluations. So that's going to be the main thing to look out for in 2024, like the launch of the Hypersearch marketplace and how that performs. The second thing is that the media industry is a great one to go for go-to-market, because journalism everywhere is in need of a business model, and because internet has really affected their revenue. Where they were earlier getting a lot of ad revenue, that's all been taken over by Facebook and Google. So the entire industry is actually looking for new solutions rather than kind of trying to block competitors and all, like, and like new ideas. They're actually really desperate for new ideas right now, just because all of their bottom lines have been hit so hard in the new internet world. The third thing I would say is that like a specific go-to-market is twofold. We have two strategies for people to actually buy these impact certificates. One is going direct to donors. So like, you know, people who see an impact certificate and be like, hey, this impact is really cool, I want to support it and buy it and own it. They can go directly on our platform and give some amount of money and get some percentage of that impact report transferred to them. And the second model is when we use all of these amazing Web3 primitives that exist, things like Gitcoin quadratic funding, Octin public good staking, retro PGF of optimism. So we use all of this to get money in a central pot. And this can also be Web2 media funders who just donate money to our organization. And we use that to programmatically purchase Hypersearchs based on highest to lowest BC ratio. So if there's a journalism impact report with a benefit cost ratio of 20, that would be bought first. And then another one with a BC ratio of 15 would be bought second. And then one with 10 would be bought third. So that's also programmatic purchase. So we've already raised like $4,000 through various Gitcoin rounds for programmatic purchase of these different impact reports. So We have the central pool model, which is distributed to buy hyperserts programmatically from highest to lowest BC ratio. And we have the direct donation model, where you come on our website and you see the different impact reports and you select the one that you like.
Yeah, that would be kind of the opposite of sweeping the floors, essentially, for impact certs. So that's, I don't know what they call it, if it's lowering the ceiling or what the terminology for it is, but that's pretty awesome to see that these plural funding mechanisms can result in, you know, the people who have the most impact automatically getting like recompensated. And so one thing I wanted to talk about is, I mean, you mentioned a lot of primitives, and especially from the perspective of a tech founder, like there is a whole bunch of things you need to look at. You need to look at, like, first, how am I going to, you know, to talk to users, understand the problem? You already kind of came from that sense. But then it's like, how do I actually build this MVP? And then what is the primitives in the Web3 space, much of which you're implementing? You mentioned hyperserts is just now coming out. Even certain chains, you know, you're very in the Arbitrum ecosystem. I know, like, what VoiceDeck is what on Optimism, and it's like certain of these primitives may not exist on the chain that I'm using, is the cost associated with, whether it's their social authentication. So when you're looking at the actual development of an MVP, how did you begin to kind of pick and choose these primitives to build the experience that you want?
Yeah, I think one major thing is to just look at the ecosystems that exist. So, for example, HyperCerts is built by Protocol Labs, which has like a very big and wide ecosystem. So they are the right people to build on and to be with, because you know that they have a reputation and are reliable. Optimism is good because they already have an ethos of retroactive funding. And what we are trying to do is create a new way of retro funding, which is more mathematical rather than a popularity contest, and use that to fund journalism, which is a completely new use case for retro funding. So there's a lot of cultural alignment between us and Optimism. So that was another factor. And the third was, of course, like the smart contracts that we want to leverage. HyperCerts is on Optimism. So that also then just makes the decision easier. In terms of actually building the MVP, like that was really hard because a lot of the funding you get is too small to actually hire the best talent for building an MVP. And in Web3, it's actually super important to get the best talent because you don't want your users to get their wallets compromised or anything by hiring subpar talent. And the way we actually broke out of this cycle was the breakthrough came when I got selected as a Next Billion Fellow at the Ethereum Foundation, which is a very unique support program. So they basically, again, for all the listeners who are thinking of applying, like definitely apply to the Next Billion Fellowship. It's like one of the best programs I've been part of. So they have calls with you every month where they try to figure out what's blocking your progress and how they can unblock that. So what they saw was that I had these media outlets on board. They had a database of impact, but we didn't have a content management system to upload those impacts. We didn't have a team to actually take those on chain and record them as hyperserts and integrate with the marketplace. So they connected me to a team in the Ethereum Foundation called Poland Labs, which, like the name suggests, they move from project to project. Every 3 months, they choose a new project to build. So they chose my project and they built out the entire MVP and got the full open source repo started out. So they are the ones who helped build out our entire version one, which is an amazing form of ecosystem support, right? Like even if they gave me $1 million, I would still have to hire a team and look at runway and all of those other questions. Whereas here, Ethereum just gave me a team of 7 developers, a designer, a product manager, and they're like, show us what you can do now. You have a full team and like work with them and get your MVP built out. So yeah, it's definitely been a difficult journey, but like I think it was super important, the role of Poland Labs in kind of making sure our launch is happening this summer.
Now that's incredible. I know even from my perspective in the near ecosystem, building a lot of these public good funding from scratch and impact and things like that, the audits, the getting the best engineers, it is a challenge, especially for public goods funding and getting that initial MVP, getting that traction, even is needed to warrant retro PGF and things like that, that are future options for funding. And there's so much that I wanted to like break down in there, but mentioned like Ethereum Foundation, which is its own ecosystem, and I know that you're very, very involved in the Arbitrum DAO ecosystem and the treasury there, and I wanted to kind of take that ecosystem lens and kind of transition to what the Arbitrum is doing, which is, I think, one of the most beautiful case studies. Like, so traditionally in a lot of these ecosystems, they have a lab that they're building the technology, and they have a foundation, maybe a Swiss nonprofit that is allocated the ecosystem treasury, and they do a lot of, you know, the building and the acquisition of projects and the legal and the compliance. One thing I really like about Arbitrum is that that foundation, most of the money lies in the DAO, and then the foundation is doing legal compliance, and there's still the labs focusing on tech on that parallel. And so I wanted to understand how that evolution came about, because we're in the process in the ecosystem trying to get that money into a DAO. And I, even for something like you mentioned, RetroPGF, they're allocating money for Retro, and they have badge holders and things like that, but it's not necessarily all entirely through a DAO. So can you talk about like the Arbitrum background, how that even came about?
Yeah, so I think the biggest difference is that even with Optimism, like the foundation or the team just announces these changes, and there's no on-chain vote, or like even the recent changes that they just announced today for making it retro funding and not funding public goods, not funding educational initiatives, focusing on four narrow categories. This was all decided unilaterally and extremely centralized. Even the treasury of Optimism is basically controlled by the foundation, and like OP holders get to vote in elections every once in a while. But other than that, there's no real utility to OP as a governance token. Whereas what's unique to Arbitrum is that at the stage of decentralization, off-chain labs is like has about like off-chain labs team and their investors had about 43% of the token supply, which was locked up and is starting to get unlocked now. They gave 10% to the Arbitrum Foundation for managing the legal and compliance and some small forms of ecosystem support. But the bulk of the treasury was relegated to the DAO and locked up in a governor contract on Tally. So when you actually lock it up in a governor contract, the only way of actually getting that money out is an on-chain vote of all the token holders who've delegated ARB, or an emergency action of the Security Council, which is not going to be invoked normally. So the only practical way of actually getting that $7 billion treasury of Arbitrum, actually putting it to use, is an on-chain vote of all the ARB holders, which is extremely unique, right? Every other ecosystem is saying, oh yeah, gradual decentralization, which doesn't usually come. Like very few have actually gradually decentralized. Whereas with Arbitrum, it was like sudden shock treatment decentralization, you know, that, hey, we've locked up all of this money in a governor contract, and the only way is of actually using that money is an on-chain vote, and like best of luck to you guys. Like we never see that happening. So I think that's what's very unique about Arbitrum, and that's what makes it super special as well, that anyone can just come and make a proposal and actually get it passed and like get to work with that. Like it's extremely permissionless in who can contribute. You just have to get a proposal passed somehow. So I think that's what's super unique about the Arbitrum space and what's about Arbitrum DAO in particular.
So as an ecosystem practitioner, we have a lot, and especially in the EVM ecosystem, where it's relatively easy to take the overall Ethereum mindshare and then get them kind of onboarded. What would you say is the most kind of aligned or the highest priorities for the Arbitrum ecosystem that would really appeal to get a proposal in and passed?
Right. So like my job was to work on treasury diversification. But what I found was that the biggest delegates didn't want diversification. They said, earning yield and other things are not really kind of what we should be focusing on. We should be focusing more on how do we actually deploy the money that we have in our treasury to make sure Arbitrum retains its lead and that we grow our ecosystem. So because again, the mandate of the DAO is ecosystem growth, whereas the foundation focuses on legal compliance and off-chain labs focuses on tech. So even if we are diversifying the treasury, we have to do it in a way that is ecosystem growth. And So a proposal which we currently have on Tally, which I worked on, was diversifying 35 million ARB, which is around $60 million today, into buying tokenized RWAs. And the way that we actually sold it to delegates wasn't that, hey, we are going to diversify because 100% of our treasury is in ARB, which is probably not a good idea. We should diversify some of it, earn yield on the money. That argument didn't work at all, like, to delegates. What did work was when we spoke to RWA protocols on Arbitrum and other ecosystems, what a lot of them told us was that we don't want grants because we have investors, we have enough money, we don't need free money. What we need is TVL. We need Arbitrum DAO to be a customer of our tokenized T-bill or a tokenized money market instrument and to actually earn money from our product. Like, what better endorsement of a protocol than to say Arbitrum DAO is our customer and earning money from our product. So that's where we really came on this insight that, hey, let's actually use this money and create conditions. So, like, for example, if Franklin Templeton's token called Benji, they are currently on Stellar and Polygon, we obviously want them to come on Arbitrum. So we would say that, hey, we'll give you an allocation of 5 million or 10 million on the condition that you have a timeline for coming to Arbitrum with your token and with your money market instrument. And if they don't come in that timeline, we withdraw the TVL from them and give it to another provider who is on that, who is in our ecosystem. So it actually becomes a very practical way of doing ecosystem growth, because you're not actually spending money, you're actually earning money. But at the same time, you're boosting the best protocols, because the truth is that grants of free money attract grifters, whereas being a customer means you gravitate towards the best products, and the best products are what we want on Arbitrum.
Yeah, and that's, I feel like, one of the drivers. If there isn't liquidity in there and there isn't the opportunity to make money, most people come are you know, grant hunters, and it's not a sustainable way, because after, you know, they build their initial MVP or they make that integration into your chain, they're going to not have any incentives around there. And I think naturally you want an ecosystem that brings in people without having to do BD. But it's very interesting to see that normally the BD arm of a foundation, of what would be in a Polygon Tech or a Solana Foundation or a Near, that is seem to be done by the DAO in a sense of attracting those customers and potential leads and things like that. So how do you see that translating differently from the roles of a DAO and the roles of a foundation in terms of the BD arm?
So I think like when you have a closed organization like a foundation, then it's only the employees who are hired who will do BD in the first place. Whereas when you have a DAO that does it, you can get any contributor to actually come and start contributing and working. And that actually is a much more effective way of doing BD, because when you have it permissionless and anyone can come and contribute, like, they are going to post on Twitter. Even now when there are protocols talking about launching, like, you know, even though I'm not paid to do it, I'll just say, hey, you should launch on Arbitrum and you should do it and you should come over here. So, like, you develop a much more organic and a much better BD strategy by actually giving power to the DAO to do it. And the way you give power is not by platitudes, but by actually locking up a large amount of money, which can only be taken out by the DAO, which we see very few ecosystems actually doing that.
And so the actual close is that organization either deploying or making a proposal for their deployment there. That's incredible. There's something that you mentioned in the past about vendor lock-in. So a lot of times when I'm making a proposal to a particular grant organization, I don't want my competitors or the people who are in my industry to get that grant. And oftentimes a lot of people will be, you know, kind of hunting for different teams and things like that, but not really being transparent about it. And that's kind of, especially in these plural systems and a lot of us who are building public goods, it's a very... brings a very negative culture. So how does that work where, like, you put in proposals where you need to actually support multiple vendors in the same sector, but at the same time you have this kind of BD decentralized proposed grant flow going on?
Yeah, I think like what we've seen happen is that when you entertain proposals from individual businesses saying that, hey, this is our proposal, please fund us, what that leads to is like a race to the finish where all of their competitors are then going to post their own individual proposal, and all of the time of delegates goes in just reviewing and vetting these proposals and voting on them. So it, like, everyone has to race to get their proposal in before the gravy train runs out. So what Arbitrum DAO did, like what Optimism did, was elect grant councils, which basically those councils will then determine who gets funding. Whereas the approach which Arbitrum took was creating frameworks. So if you're coming to propose money individually to you, those almost always get voted down. An example is like the what was called the Arbitrum Coalition, where Blockworks and Trail of Bits and some other people came together saying that let's work and contribute to Arbitrum and, like, you know, this, and fund us for it. It was rejected. Then the same proposal got packaged as something called the Arbitrum Research and Development Cooperative, where it was a framework for anyone to come and apply for the research wing, to come and apply for the security wing. And so then we had applications coming from 15 different vendors, and then there was an election to determine which one to select. So Blockworks got selected after that. So even though when they came direct to the DAO, it was rejected. When the same proposal was put as a framework with an election to elect the service provider, Blockworks got selected for it, you know. And so I think that's one way of doing it. The second way is that you kind of frame it as an experiment for the DAO. So you think, you say things like, this is the problem that we want to solve. These are all of the different solutions that can be, this is like, this is a map of all of the solutions to the problem. And let's now fund at least two solutions so that we have data at the end of 1 year about which solution worked better. That is much more likely to pass than just saying, hey, my solution is awesome, please fund me for it. Like, those business sort of deals don't work very well in Arbitrum, but actually framing it as an experiment where you're going to get data and you're going to see which one worked better, that is much more likely to pass. Because in proposals, like, people are always assessing, is this person a missionary or a mercenary? And when you frame it as an experiment, it sounds way more missionary than being like, hey, give me money for my solution and for my team, which comes across as a mercenary.
Yeah, there's so much insight here. Do you have more time? How much more time do you have, or do you have to cut off?
Yeah, I have like half an hour more, so no worries.
Okay. Because I have so much more questions. I think this is something, you know, I've been working in NIR for a couple of years, and we've been, a lot of these things we've made in mistakes. And I think from the get go, a lot of things that you're saying should be implemented. But one of the things I find, even dealing with a bunch of different DAOs, dealing with grants, is there's still an element of politics. There's still an element of delegators. There's still an element of, okay, Off-Chain Labs has this much tokens, and there is alignment in that sense, that there's still, the foundation may have as well. And so how do you navigate the rallying of the support of the, is it just a proposal in and then they get into like 1 week of, you know, review, or is it more of you have to actually get buy-in with the delegators and the stakeholders and talk to them? What's that process look like?
So, you know, when I made my RWA proposal initially, like, the selection mechanism was supposed to be delegates vote on different service providers, and depending on the proportion of votes, they get that much allocation. So if one provider gets 30% of the vote, they get 30% of the allocation. But when we spoke to the delegates, like, the feedback we got from them was, please do not make us select individual service providers, because then they'll be constantly messaging us and harassing us for votes, and we definitely don't want that. So what they preferred was electing a neutral expert committee, which would look into each provider, recommend an allocation amongst them, and then put that as a yes or no vote to the DAO. So in this scenario, like, lobbying becomes way less important, because the only role of the delegates and the token holders is actually electing a committee, which is credible and has their own reputation. So, and then that committee makes the decisions of how much to give, and it's only ratification of the DAO. So that's kind of one way to avoid the issue of too much politics and too much lobbying And like, it's again, it's only frameworks that get passed by Arbitrum. So because of that, like, even then it's more neutral, you know, it's not like, hey, fund this proposal because my team is depending on the money. It's more like fund this framework, which is going to help grow the RWA vertical on Arbitrum or help grow the gaming vertical on Arbitrum. So in that sense, it becomes more credibly neutral in its proposal stage.
One thing that's hard, because like even in the review of standards, for example, or even in the near ecosystem, we have grassroots DAOs. There's still a council or an area of subject matter experts that you have to source. And what is that like a temporary for that proposal, or are there like strict work groups that are appointed and paid, or like what level of additional governance is there to support that?
Yeah, that's actually one of the hardest questions that Arbitrum DAO is currently struggling with, which is how do we determine the right amount of compensation to people who are actually working on implementing a proposal? So everybody agrees that, yeah, this RWA proposal is great. Where we are facing some headwinds is how did we propose a incentive or compensation for the committee members? And that is where things get very contentious. And that's something which we're trying to work through as a DAO right now. That how do we actually streamline the process of paying people who draft these proposals, paying people who are on a committee to determine selection of providers in a proposal? That's something which we are still not adequately figured out so far. So that's definitely been an issue for us.
I mean, like going back to before with, you know, the VoiceDeck and, you know, creating those impact certs and things like that, are there any, like, how would you contrast that? Like, what are the primary metrics? Are you looking at the TVL someone's brought, the amount of projects, the amount of builders? I think we mentioned what Optimism launched yesterday, where they specified on-chain builders and dev tooling and, you know, sequencer fees and traction as kind of their main priorities now. Is there kind of like a framework like that, but then a quantifiable metrics you can use to compensate or that is beginning to be thought of in the process?
Yeah, so a lot of it is based on estimations that, like, so, okay, this is the other cool thing, that the average rate, like when you're working with Arbitrum DAO, the amount that everyone agrees on is $100 an hour. So then it becomes super easy to actually hire someone because we just have to make it a binary choice. Do we want to work with this person? Do we not want to work with the person? Because the compensation is fixed at $100 an hour, you know? So that makes it like there's no like level of like negotiation, which is super complex to do in a decentralized DAO. It's more like, do we want to work with this person? Yes or no? If it's yes, we pay them $100 an hour. So that's kind of how we've determined some of the compensation. But sometimes you don't want to do an hourly rate. You want to just like give them a flat fee for performing some sort of service. So there we've not figured out a standardized way of doing it, but hopefully getting there soon.
No, that's incredible. A lot of time, like we'll do, and I've seen a lot of other organizations do, they'll do the hourly rate, but they'll do it based on maybe an Amazon software engineer earns this much, and this is the regional version of that. And they take in like levels.fyi, and they use tools like this. So having a competitive $100 hour rate, that's incredible for attracting talent. And so, yeah, that's something I think quantifiable impact is something that really needs to be, it's in its infant stages right now. This kind of made me think of a thought of like, I didn't ask for the VoiceDeck, but like a lot of times everyone's adopting EAS, right? Like everyone is doing Ethereum attestation services. And so where do you like, say you develop an impact framework, like how would you choose between putting it on EAS and or minting it as a cert or anything like that? Are these solutions you guys looked at, or how would you explain the difference?
Yeah, it's like super complementary because hypercerts are tokenized attestations. So attestations by themselves are not tokens. They are attestations. So the way that we are integrating both of them is that you create a hypercert of the impact, and then you have multiple evaluators each creating their own attestation using EAS, which gives like the benefit cost ratio and other things of that sort. So attestations are what gives a hypercert value.
Awesome, awesome. And yeah, and so like kind of going off what we were talking about before, in terms of like, you mentioned liquidity incentives, and I think that's been very successful. I ask projects like all the time, like where they're going to, and like I talked to a project yesterday, and they're going to Arbitrum because they got motion, they got volume going on, and so I think that's very effective. But in terms of other priorities outside of incentives, what do you think is in this kind of next phase is going to really catapult the adoption of Arbitrum as opposed to other L2s and other L1s?
Yeah, I think it's mostly to a large extent like Arbitrum Stylus. So Arbitrum Stylus is it's the thing that Offchain Labs is working on now in terms of their tech focus, which is creating smart contracts in any programming language, whether that's JavaScript or C++, because a large part of how reaching new users is going to happen is actually reaching like developers in Fortune 500 companies who don't know Solidity, who don't know Rust, but they do know JavaScript. So actually allowing them to use Arbitrum stack by using the language that they are comfortable with, I think that's what's going to boost a lot of Arbitrum's growth in the future, Arbitrum Stylus. And even at a larger level, like Arbitrum's brand is freedom. Arbitrum is freedom to launch your own Orbit chain without any compulsions of maintaining parity with Bedrock like OP stack chains have. They can launch their own chain and you can do whatever you want with it. You know, you have a community license. You can modify it how you want. It's freedom to create a smart contract in your own language and not have to use Solidity or Rust. So I think that's what's really going to drive Arbitrum going forward, like this full narrative of freedom and the tech improvements. And even the fact that we even have freedom in the DAO, right? Like anyone can come and contribute. You don't need to go through a hiring manager or other things to kind of actually be a contributor to Arbitrum or even win an election. Like in Optimism, it's again, it's like grant councils and others that determine most of the decisions and allocations. And but in Arbitrum, like anyone can just come make their own proposal, create their own council, get something passed. And that's something we don't see in a lot of places.
No, that's incredible. There are some concepts that I think might have went over people's head. And so Arbitrum is a layer 2 blockchain, right? Like a layer 2 on Ethereum. And they traditionally, most of the contracts are built in EVM. Offchain Labs, the people who like developed the protocol, they are building something called Stack, which to me was incredible. Like I'm in the New York system, so everything compiles down to WASM and you can add other language support. So that was actually a major case study for why we should adopt Move support or use Eclipse for the Solana VM or anything like that. I was really, that to me was absolutely incredible. But instead of actually building that implementation, down to WASM, like Stylus would enable, we have JavaScript contracts on Near 2, but like having the reaching out to most Web2 developers, because I think Solidity is maybe like 20,000 devs. And even if you know Rust, you have to learn Solana contracts. You have to learn their VM. You have to learn Near's VM. You have to learn what Cosmos is doing and Polkadot is doing. It's still very siloed in the adoption. So like, just to kind of clarify on that, there's like a way to write your own native, language to like translate into code that works, and it's not like a layer 2 on top of a charger. It's a native implementation. I can use MetaMask, but the actual code for the application is in JavaScript or C or Lisp or whatever is compatible at the time. Is that live, or like when is that actually coming to the developer console?
Yeah, I think it's on testnet right now. Hopefully we'll see it live soon in 2024. Yep.
All right, and yeah, that's huge. And then we have this whole narrative of everybody wants to, deploy their own roll-up, deploy their own app chain. Bankless is saying there's going to be thousands of, or I don't know how many they said, there's going to be a proliferation of roll-ups and app chains. And there is a new trend where instead of launching your own token, launching your own NFT, you launch your own chain and you use your own token. And that's kind of becoming the new meta. And there is this war to launch on your own stack. Polygon has their own chain development kit. OP has, you know, the super chain, and they have, they're doing a lot in the BDF, or, you know, Base is an example of it, Zora is an example, Mantle's an example of this, and then, you know, Arbitrum has these orb chains. So can you kind of outline the differences and the trade-offs in interop, and how, like, why someone would come to and build an Arbitrum chain, and, like, what is outside, what is in the box for that solution?
Yeah, I think the basic decision you would need to make, before that, you should only launch your own chain if you have about 1.5 to 3 million transactions a year. That's like the number that I've heard secondhand from Conduit. That's when it starts making economic sense to actually launch your own chain. You have 1.5 to 3 million transactions per year. So assume you have these many transactions. How do you choose which stack to use? So the basic thing is that the spectrum is interoperability versus customizability. So if you want interoperability with Base and OP mainnet and Zora and interoperability within the EVM ecosystem, it makes sense to sometimes go for OP stack. Whereas if you want full customizability, then it's better to go for Arbitrum Orbit chains, because there's no restriction on how you can customize it and how you can do it. Whereas Optimism has a restriction that you have to be compatible with Bedrock. So that prevents some use cases when you have to actually always maintain compatibility with Bedrock. And that allows interoperability. So it has its pluses, it has its positives, but it's at the cost of customizability. So that's the basic trade-offs that I would urge people to consider who are launching their own app chain.
Yeah, and so people who don't know, Conduit is, there's these things called RASs that are more like roll-up as a service providers that essentially abstract a lot of what it takes to build a chain. Conduit is an example of that. So, I mean, how does value for having your own orb chain actually accrue to the Arbitrum ecosystem? What are the incentives around that?
Yeah, so I think the recent proposal is that 8% of sequencer revenue in op chains goes to the DAO, and 2% goes to something called the Arbitrum Developers Guild, who are building the core tech of Arbitrum. So 2% and 8%, so 10% goes to Arbitrum. So that's how the economics work at a transaction level. And then there are, of course, like the network benefits and using ARB in that ecosystem and other things which aren't fully fleshed out yet. But what is fleshed out is 8% to the DAO and 2% to the Arbitrum Developers Guild.
Yeah, this is kind of like the protocol guild of Arbitrum. And so going off of that, like a lot of times we see initially the labs are the innovators of the protocol. They're the central like mission drive for the tech stack. They're the ones with the best engineers. How, in terms of the guild sense, are people contributing to the Arbitrum protocol? Is there a lot of contributors there, or is it like is there interest to expand that, or how does that work?
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with how the tech part of Arbitrum is organized, because a lot of it is dealt with by off-chain labs. Even the Developers Guild is still in the very early stage. I don't think it's active yet, and it's still in the works of how do we structure it and how do we fund it initially. So these are all works in progress, but right now we have off-chain labs who's taking the lead role on the tech. And I don't know if there are many individual contributors to Arbitrum, right now at least. Again, I'm not in the know for this because I'm not a developer, I'm a journalist. So it's something which I'm not too familiar with.
Okay. And so one thing in terms of like the ecosystem perspective, like that I really struggle with. So I knew we had like our own EVM Aurora, and you can actually, we have an Aurora cloud stack similar there. What I found very difficult for people deploying to Aurora who come from another Ethereum ecosystem is actual stickiness and developing on that chain, and they may deploy to another chain, or it's so easy to deploy it to another blockchain. So how do you what is the stickiness of people coming from other Ethereum ecosystems? Is there like a unique Arbitrum culture that lies outside of like just liquidity at the moment? Like, what would you say is that culture differentiator and that stickiness that keeps people from other EVM ecosystems around?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing for apps to launch on multiple chains, and that's certainly not something we want to discourage. What we want is to make sure that they also launch on Arbitrum. So one of the ways we do that is by just having a very good and vibrant user base. So every app will eventually want to launch on Arbitrum just by virtue of our size and volume. And then you can actually give specific incentives, like if you have a DAO ecosystem support program, then you can only avail it if you have launched on Arbitrum or if you have a plan to launch on Arbitrum. And so that's the second way of doing it. So I think that's the main, like, even like there was this tweet by the Offchain Labs founders that, like, we give zero grants, you know, to apps and all on our chain. But like most of them stuck with us because of the tech and because of, like, you know, the culture and the ethos. And that's what actually creates the stickiness. When you have a culture that people appreciate and people like, then, like, there's no amount of incentives which is going to get people to migrate to another chain after that.
So for, you know, in the case of, say someone gets liquidity or they, you know, launch a token, they launch a DAO, they launch an NFT collection, they actually have their community base for what might be a multi-chain application living on Arbitrum. Like, what would you say is the most effective things? Like in the EVM ecosystem, the Aurora ecosystem, what they experimented with, for example, is they had an allocation of, like, basically, if you allocate a certain percentage of your tokens, you to the, like, Aurora treasury, then there was this allocation of all the ecosystem tokens. When you stake Aurora, you'll get essentially airdropped all those tokens, and they will get, like, preferential grants and things like that. I saw, like, a tweet where you mentioned, like, token swaps and things like that. So, like, what are kind of experiments that you've seen that can really enforce that or haven't been implemented?
Yeah, that's actually the next proposal that I'm working on for Arbitrum DAO, which is a token swap program where I, like, you know, again, it's a way to diversify our treasury, which is entirely in ARB, and own the tokens of the biggest projects in our ecosystem, while at the same time supporting them as well, because ARB has way more liquidity than all of those other tokens. So they can actually use that to fund their operations, to grow their own project and to grow their ecosystem. So I think rather than giving grants where you don't always capture the upside, you're going to have projects going to other ecosystems, which also give them grants. I think when you do token swaps, we actually make sure that even, like, if they become successful, we can capture that upside. So we actually want them to go on other chains as well, because it's going to increase the value of our treasury. And we can also get a voice in their governance. So when they decentralize and Arbitrum has their tokens, we can actually vote and influence the direction that they take. So I think token swaps are how you should do ecosystem growth for the mature projects in your ecosystem. So it starts off, in Arbitrum's case, it'll start off with something like a Questbook grant. So Questbook and Thrivecoin are the two service providers who are kind of managing individual grant projects in Arbitrum. So if you are wanting to get a grant from Arbitrum, do not go direct to the DAO, because we don't have time to entertain individual proposals. Instead, we funded Questbook and Plurality Labs with about $4 million each. And they are the ones who can give projects individual small grants to launch and to get started. So the journey in Arbitrum might start off with a Questbook grant, and it might end with a token swap. So, which is direct to the DAO. So even the way we are structuring token swaps is we have elected deal makers, and then these deal makers kind of negotiate deals with different apps, put those deals on Tally, directly on Tally, and then when the DAO votes to approve it, the money is transferred out into Hedgy using an escrow tool they've developed. And then if the other DAO also approves it, then the swap happens. So it's entirely on chain, and which is something you need, because often when you announce these deals, the token price goes up a lot, and then that changes the full economics of it. So you want your announcement to be in the form of a deal on Tally, which is directly uploaded and people vote on from both DAOs.
Now that's incredible to have two portals for grants. I'm very interested on the insights that Plurality Labs has, and also the guys at Questbook. They're shipping a lot, actually. Shout out to, like, Reclaim and all the identity solutions. So gotta love what's coming out, you know, India founders. So shout out, shameless plug to Reclaim and Questbook and what they're doing there. But yeah, that's super, like, super insightful on the token swap element of things. You mentioned other ecosystems, and I don't know what ecosystems you identify in. You're like, you're building an app on OP, you were part of the Ethereum Fellows Next Billion program, you're in the Arbitrum ecosystem. I saw you at the Gitcoin House really urging Gitcoin and other people to get involved in L2 governance. So, like, where, how do you even keep track of all these layer twos and where their governance portals are and the amount of, like, bandwidth it actually takes to engage with that?
Right. So I take part in their governance. So mostly just looking at their governance forum about once a week and commenting over there, seeing what's up, whether they have elections for taking part. So I'm on the Gitcoin and the Octant Council. So the way I tell it is that if I want to onboard a new user into Web3, the three things I tell them to do is to obtain an ENS name, to vote in Gitcoin rounds, and to lock up some GLM token into Octant, which is a public good staking platform, which allows you to give rewards to various projects. So those are the three actions I tell people to take. So that's why I have to be a little selective in the DAOs that I contribute to in terms of governance. So right now it's Gitcoin and Octant for their governance, which are apps, and Optimism and Arbitrum for which are chains and taking part in that. And that kind of keeps my hands more than full.
What, I mean, how do you kind of look at the overall landscape of things? I see, I mean, I'm more in the non-EVM side of things. I mean, near, I'm looking at a bunch of other chains, a lot of places where Gitcoin isn't necessarily having their attention that are Rust-based. And I'm looking at it from a perspective of, like, the things that people are doing in the EVM ecosystem are making the case for public goods funding. They're making a case for impact certs, but we can take this to every single chain. And this is, you know, multi-billion dollar ecosystem that's coming about that may have no public goods funding apparatus. And this is a huge opportunity to allocate capital into public goods funding in general. So how, when you see the new Solanas of the world, or the Suis, or the Aptoses, or the Polkadots and the Cosmoses, or whatever new L2 or anything like that, or even people who are in the EVM system, like the Say and the modular chains and things like that, like, do you look to their ecosystems, or like what would you recommend for people who may be ecosystem practitioners over there?
Yeah, I think, like, the one thing I look at is, like, as an industry, we've managed to solve the scaling issue, which wasn't the case even a few years ago. So now that we've solved the scaling issue, the biggest question is, how do we sell all the block space that is being produced? And a lot of them are empty block space, you know, for many chains. So that's really the most urgent issue for our industry now, which is what I'd like to keep most on top of. So, like, even with Gitcoin or Octant, like, they're creating new use cases for block space. Same with impact certificates, you know, a new use case for all the block space we're producing. So it's kind of like, irrespective of the ecosystem, we all win when we unlock a new use case for block space. And that's really, I think, what unifies all of us in this space.
What would you say is the most exciting use cases that you want to see outside of journalism?
I think the line in Gitcoin's white paper 2.0, which is how do we combine internet speed information with blockchain level transparency to allocate capital. So with the traditional model of allocating capital, you can never keep pace with the speed of the internet, which is so much information coming at you, because you have a commit, you have a gatekeepers, basically, whether it's VCs who are sitting as VCs and, like, kind of deciding things, and, like, you know, there are two or three partners and they can't possibly process all of the information on the internet. So I think that's what's most exciting for me, the ability to allocate capital in a transparent manner using blockchain, while also having internet speed information within your decision making. So I think capital allocation and doing that more efficiently, more fairly, more credibly neutral, that's the most exciting use case for blockchains for me.
Yeah, I will link the Gitcoin white paper 2.0 in all the links in the show notes. It's pretty amazing seeing really as public goods funding turn into allocation, which is essentially moving money and using signals to determine that, which is a very broad concept and can be applied to a bunch of different use cases. So on the road to a billion, which is, you know, Arbitrum has 7 billion, Optimism, they have like 3 or 4 billion in terms of their treasury. These layer twos have that capital directly in the ecosystem. It's going to be very interesting to see how they begin to use these stacks and these funding mechanisms, how people contribute there. So I'm super excited to that, and also building a lot of these primitives in other ecosystems as well. So that was super insightful. We went into a lot of things, from your journey as a journalist to when you're college dean, or what's it called, the college principal, and then from actually building an application that addresses it to getting involved in governance. There's been so much alpha here. What would you say what would you say to people who are getting into the industry outside of getting involved in governance, that may see all this degeneracy and they want to do something impactful? Like, what would you tell them to inspire them on, like, a closing note?
To just look past the noise and the public perceptions and others, and to actually look at communities that are building new use cases, especially in the public good space. I think that's that part of crypto has really matured, the entire public goods funding space. So really getting more involved in that as an entry into the larger ecosystem. So I came in through Gitcoin and the entire community they've built up. And now I've moved on to Arbitrum and the other and the wider governance field. So that's really been a kind of very easy entry point for anyone, because everyone wants to make the world a better place, right? So Gitcoin has actually got an amazing group of people who are all idealists and visionaries. And so really using that as an entry point is, and again, just attend conferences. When you attend any of the big crypto conferences, you won't find the scammers and all of that at those conferences for the most part. You'll find the dedicated builders and the idealists and the mavericks, and you'll find all of those. So those are the two things, try to get into the public good space, attend a real life conference.
All right, awesome note to end on. Thank you so much for coming, Nuvash.